KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Akutan, Alaska.
I'm a paleo nerd, I'm a paleo nerd, I'm a paleo nerd, don't you understand? I'm a paleo nerd, I'm a
paleo nerd. Hey, you beat me, darn you!
I tried to, but you were right on it, man.
Okay, all right. So, hey, we've got a great episode today, and before we obviously get into that, how are you?
I am good, sir. And how do you do?
I'm doing good. I'm wearing the Raymond Alf Museum t-shirt that our previous guest, Gabe Santos, gave us because I'm going to their grand opening when they reopen pandemic. On the very first day they reopen. And so that's going to be awesome. I snagged some tickets and a time slot in the morning. Well, and I've never been.
I was on Fossil Friday the other day with Gabe. And yeah. I told him about you wanting, so, you know, I helped arrange that.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you, Ray.
Yeah, whatever.
Thank you, Ray. Yeah, well,
I reminded him per your request. So
I did get you first in line at the STD clinic when you needed that. Remember that?
The standard training, whatever.
All discipline, right.
Yeah, discipline.
Anyway, so you texted me a picture that I've seen many times before when I lived in Ketchikan, and it's a bunch of your garbage. Why would you text me a picture of your garbage strewn out on your... Don't you know that there are bins to put it in, Ray?
Well, the thing is, David, it's actually not my garbage. It's the neighbor's garbage because we take care of our garbage here. And you know, I mean, the bears are back, dude. So the bear drug that up into our yard this morning. Look out this morning. Right. There it is. But yeah, we're always trying to find out which neighbor it is. So we looked through. This neighbor was drinking vodka and had some chicken bones in there.
Wait, hold on. The bear was drinking vodka?
Well, actually, the bear did lick out the vodka bottle. But bears, it turns out, they really, really love mayonnaise because the mayonnaise jar was thoroughly licked out. And anyways, the bear.
Okay, so this is the black bear. Okay,
it's a black bear
in
yeah.
Ketchikan on the big huge island of Revilla Hejado. You say Gagato, I say Hejado.
I say Revilla.
So. Oh, just Revilla for sure.
Revilla.
There are black bears. There are no brown bears, grizzly bears, but the black bear is what, the Ursus americanus.
That's
like
right,
that?
Sir. You got it. Yeah.
Okay, that's it from memory.
Yeah, there you go.
I didn't have time to Google that one. Do they hibernate in the Ketchikan during the winter? Is it that cold? Is it get cold enough that they go away?
Yeah, you know, and they go into torpor, or they sleep in the woods, and then they
torpor,
you know, torpor, like, you know, sometimes your eyes glaze
over. Is that a word? Is that a word of?
Dude, you don't know that word?
It sounds very familiar.
That's torpor right there. You know.
Oh.
Yeah, they go into hibernation, they hibernate, they go into deep, deep sleep. And you know, that made me realize something about my ravens that I've been missing so dearly.
Oh, right.
You know, they disappeared on me, you know, come March. They were like occupied with other things. And then I realized just yesterday when I was walking through town and I could still hardly see any ravens around, I realized, wait, it's because the entire landscape has come alive, right?
Okay.
There's a thing called the seasons. And actually, I realized, and then I saw a little robin over there, and I realized, wait a minute, there's a big source of protein that just arrived in town. That's why they don't care about me and my peanuts.
You mean the bait fish? You mean the herring arrive
I'm thinking about
the eggs?
I'm thinking about baby robins, and ravens like to raid those nests.
Okay, that's right. They do
raid. And there's
raid.
Hummingbirds, and there's, you know, there's sparrows that come, and there's bugs that come alive, and like, they don't need me anymore. It's a season.
Yeah.
And then the bears wake up, and they drag the neighbor's garbage into my yard, because I do the responsible thing, and that bear that's rummaging through the neighbor's stuff is probably going to die because after a while,
because
it's a problem
bear.
Because
of all the human crap that he ate. Yeah, that's
and,
so sad.
Well, it's not just the human crap. Somebody's, the fish and game will have to come out and shoot him. you know, because
what?
They don't relocate them. They come right back. And if this becomes so habituated that...
So he's going to be a repeat offender and they're going to have to... can't they relocate them? They don't have the funds for that?
Well, every time they try, the bear comes right back. You can put them miles away, helicopter them away, and they come back.
Okay, I have these squirrel traps, and in the last 7 days, I have captured 15 squirrels, 2 rats, and a skunk.
Ooh, and a skunk?
Yeah, the 15 squirrels, I drive about 4 miles away across a road and across a river gully. So it's a different watershed.
And are they sitting in the car there with you looking at you like, where are we going? What's going on?
No, it's in the back of my truck. So I keep them in the cage until I release them. And I release them all, thinking they're the same family. I release them all by the same huge grove of oak trees. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, you're transplanting rats, though. That's very kind of you, dude.
Well, I wouldn't do it except they're digging under my foundation and the squirrels are digging under my deck and they're compromising my structure. So, I'm not going to kill them. I'm going to trap them and release them.
If you would like to try relocating our bears up here, you're welcome to do that. So you come on up and... you could build a better bear trap, and then you could drive them somewhere, Dave. But I am afraid that this one is going to have to die after a while. We'll see what happens, man.
Right. That's so sad. There are so many locales in the lower 48 that have bears. I mean, the entire Georgia and the East Coast and the Appalachian Mountains. I mean, there are black bears all over the lower 48. Actually, I'd love to see their range.
I have read that the bears in Appalachia, like in Pennsylvania, are actually bigger than our Alaskan black bears.
Right.
But
I hear that they make some pretty good moonshine, too.
The bears do? What? Anyways, all right.
Speaking of Appalachia, our guest today, he is a geologic knowledgeable wonder.
So he's from the east. He's actually from the southeast. He's from Georgia and...
It's the South, right?
Are you going to get all Southern on us here, man?
Maybe right now I will, but not later.
But wait, did you know, I did some research. Did you know that there are 4 geologic sections in Georgia?
I do. I've done some research, too. As you know, we try to sound knowledgeable when we have our guests on. And I think we can ask our guests about that today.
Well, I'll tell you before we talk.
Oh, okay. Cover it right now. All right.
Yeah. There's 4 geologic kind of areas in Georgia. The Appalachia Plateau, the Blue Ridge, the Piedmont, and Coastal Plain. Now, Appalachia Plateau is pretty much Ordovician, 440 million years ago.
I say Ordovician. I've got the T-shirt on today.
They are so Ordovician.
To represent with trilobites, too.
You know, from my years of Spanish, I just always turn I's into E sounds. So sorry.
You're an international guy. So cool. Go ahead.
The Blue Ridge geologic area is mostly metamorphic, and they found gold in 1828 there.
Ooh, really?
Gold! So much gold, they started a mint in Georgia.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Didn't know that.
That was one of the places they had a Georgia mint.
You've done your research.
The Piedmont is igneous and metamorphic about 250, 350 million years ago, but it's also sedimentary that was metamorphosized into a big Ketchikan, Alaska-like gluey.
It's been cooked. It's been baked. So not so
fossil. And then there's the coastal plain,
which
is Cretaceous to Holocene, so it spans the whole age of mammals.
There are a lot of cool fossils found in that area, and there's a few I want to ask our guests about in particular. So
what do you say we call them?
Let's call them up. We're going to call. Should we reveal who we're calling?
Why do you always make it sound like it's a secret?
Well, I guess they know by now. They tuned in. We're going to call Cam Muskelly down in Georgia. Georgia on my mind. Let's call Cam, man.
Okay.
Hey, Dave, meet Cameron Muskelly, paleontologist and a geologist from Georgia. Cam is a science writer, a fossil hunter, a tweeter and a YouTuber with a big social media following. And Cam, it is so very cool to finally meet you. We've been Facebook pals for a while, and I've been seeing you wearing a Paleo Nerd shirt. And really good to meet you and meet this dude here. This is David Strassman.
Hey, nice Cam. Hey, nice to meet you, too. I've seen your talks and your videos, and I've dove into your blog page. It's awesome, dude. But the question is, are you a Paleo Nerd?
You gosh darn tootin', I'm a paleo nerd.
Yeah, I thought I was the type specimen for paleo nerddom, but I think you pretty well live up to that too, my friend. And it's so very cool to meet you, and you have a really interesting background that you come from, but I know that you were a dinosaur kid just like me.
How did it all start?
Where did it all start for you, Kim?
Oh boy, yes, indeed. I still am a dinosaur guy. I love dinosaurs. I love dinosaurs all my life. I can't remember a time where I wasn't interested in dinosaurs and all prehistoric animals. I remember getting books and getting toys as a kid. I remember my mom's coworker actually gave me a stuffed Triceratops in one of those zoo books. And it had, like, I think it was, I can't remember the paleo artist's name. It may have been last name Hallett, Mark Hallett.
Oh, yeah, Mark Hallett. Yeah, he's an incredible artist. Yeah. Oregon. He lives in Oregon.
Yes, yes. And he had, the picture was of a Tyrannosaur, and there was a Pteranodon flying over. And I remember getting that as a zoo book because of my interest in dinosaurs. And when that actually happened, I just began to delve so deep into the world of dinosaurs. I was known as the dinosaur kid in class. So my nickname in school was Dinosaur Boy through elementary school, through like parts of high school. So
yeah, but it's better than being called, you know, weirdo.
I mean, technically we were weirdos because I was.
Yeah,
really,
I was
going
to say it's kind of maybe goes a little hand in hand, but there was a. I've seen some of your talks. You mentioned something that happened when you were in second grade, and if you are on your best behavior, you got to go over to the third grade classes with Miss Davis or something like that. Is that
yes? Yes.
What's that story?
I was in the second grade, and everybody knew I was interested in fossils and dinosaurs. Even my, you know, I brought dinosaur toys to school. I brought dinosaur books to class.
You were the dino kid. Yeah.
I was the dinosaur kid. If there was reading time, I would be sitting there reading a dinosaur book. No doubt about it. I checked out every single dinosaur book in my library. Yeah, if I was on my good behavior, which I typically was, if I was on my good behavior, I would go down to that class, and there was a teacher by the name of Miss Davis. Okay. She had a personal fossil collection. And she also had an interest in dinosaurs and knew that I was really interested in dinosaurs. And I would go and look at some of her fossils in her fossil collection. And in it, she had an incredible array of fossils. She had fossil crinoids. In fact, that was the first fossil that I was introduced to were crinoids. And if anybody doesn't know what a crinoid is, it's an echinoderm. They're related to starfish, and they live on a stalk. They're still living today, but they're not as...
They call them sea lilies, and for the longest time, I stupidly thought they were plants, but they're not. They're living...
Yeah, they're living animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Is it a group of animals, or is it one animal?
It's a group of animals. Right, I believe the class is called Crinoidae.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, she gave me a crinoid stem, and that was my first fossil that I got. But the fossil that stuck out to me the most, because she had plant fossils, she even had dinosaur poop. Yeah, coprolite. And I would even trick my the teacher that I had to tell her to hold this rock, and then I would trick her and say it was a fake rock, but it's actually dinosaur dung, and I could see the disgust on her face. But I was a 7-year-old kid. I was like, "Oh, this is so cool."
I like that.
But the fossil that stuck out to me the most was a trilobite. It was unlike anything that I've ever seen before. I mean, they look so different from like the plant fossils or the fossil shells that she had in her collection. And I was just that's what really triggered my interest in regards to fossils, because I've never seen fossils before. I've only read them about them in books. I've only seen them with paleontologists on National Geographic or the Discovery Channel digging them up. But I've never actually got to see or hold an actual fossil until that day.
And was this trilobite local, like from the Appalachian Plateau, or was it?
Oh, no, this was from Morocco. This was trilobite.
We all have trilobites from Morocco.
Yeah, yeah.
I actually just got reconnected with her a couple months ago, and she gave me that trilobite that started my interest.
Oh, nice. Way.
Nice.
Really?
So very nice.
I've got it right here.
That's it?
Ah, there you go. That's a Moroccan one.
Yep.
Wow.
Cam, that's so cool, because trilobites are my kind of spirit fossil animal, too. I've got one tattooed here on my arm, you know. So.
As do I.
Oh, you did?
Really?
We're gonna get a screenshot of that.
We'll do a screenshot of you guys' tattoos.
Mine has flames because you know everything looks cooler with flames, man. So, but Cam, you were diagnosed at age 8 with ASD, as being on the autism spectrum. But I've heard you talk about this before. You talk openly about it, but it kind of helped you like focus on stuff in a way, and maybe over focus or
Yeah, I was diagnosed with autism spectrum disorder at the age of 8. And yeah, I because of this, it allowed me to dive deeper into the world of geology and paleontology, because people on the autism spectrum are typically highly focused on one particular topic or even more topics in general. I know people who are super interested in space. I know people who are super interested in cars and things of that nature.
Right, right.
And my interest just happened to be paleontology and geology. And so I used paleontology and geology as an anchor, as a coping mechanism, because people who are on the autism spectrum typically get bullied a lot. And I was that type of person who got bullied severely. But I used paleontology and geology to weigh that out. And it worked.
Yeah.
Did being on the spectrum help you remember dates and nomenclature, or how did it help you as far as, I mean, you have to learn and know a lot. There's a lot of data to take in to understand what the ages are and the periods are. And so how do you think it was not a deficit, but it helped you?
It's hard to really explain because for us, really don't have an explanation on why we're able to remember what we remember. You know, it's just something that we love and we focus a lot of our time on. And we just, so I began to really remember to memorize the geological time scale. I want to say at like maybe 10 or 11.
Wow.
And I began to write mineral formulas at like around 12 or 13. So the chemical formulas of minerals and start to write them down and remember the chemistry of some of the minerals that I was collecting.
Wow. I remember you saying in one of your interviews that, and there are a lot of interviews with you online that one can find, and they're always really compelling, and your talks that you give on Paleo 101, but you said the rocks didn't make fun of you, you know? And I thought, man, that's really cool, you know?
Yeah.
It was a way for you to go to this kind of happy place, if you will, you know?
Exactly, and it's still my happy place till this day, and it will always be my happy place. Yeah. You know, if I'm feeling sad or if I'm feeling alone or depressed, the rocks are there to keep me company.
I watched a video of you finding a giant oyster.
Yes, I was, I was out there in Tupelo, Mississippi, in the Demopolis Chalk Formation, which is a late Cretaceous deposit. It's Campanian, so that's roughly about 76 to 77 million years old or so. And the Demopolis Chalk is an incredible deposit. It's in Mississippi and it's in Alabama.
Is that the edge of the Inland Sea?
It's actually a little bit more closer to the Appalachian side. So it's a little bit in eastern part of North America. It was the result of the Western Interior Seaway, but it's a little bit to the east of the actual seaway.
Right, but it was formed by the eastern edge of the Western Interior Seaway?
Yes, from the Western Interior Seaway.
And all the way to Mississippi.
Yeah, all the way to Mississippi. And there's been various different deposits that have occurred in that particular time, but the Demopolis Chalk is an important formation because it actually has dinosaur fossils. And I wasn't lucky enough to find dinosaurs, sadly, but I will say I'm going to be seeing the holotype specimens of some of those Alabamian dinosaurs.
Alabamian dinosaurs. So let me ask you this. Are those, we're going paleo now. So we're in the Cretaceous. It's Western Interior Seaway stuff. You guys are on the eastern edge of that interior seaway in the Cretaceous. Are those dinosaurs that are found in Alabama and scraps of dinosaurs, I guess, also from Georgia, are they bloat and float fossils found in the marine formations?
I love that.
Yes, they are. We don't have any terrestrial rocks that have dinosaur fossils within them, and so all the rocks that are found in the eastern part of the United States happen to be marine deposits or lag deposits. And so all the dinosaur fossils that you'll typically find are in marine sediments. And so it makes it very difficult to find nearly complete skeletons like there is in Western North America. But the dinosaurs here in Appalachia, the dinosaurs here, are very poorly studied. And so I and a couple of other paleontologists are working on finding new dinosaurs and actually understanding what the environment was like on their deposition, on how these animals were found.
Wow. So are you finding articulated bits, or are they in concretions, or where? How does one find a dinosaur in the East?
And where in Georgia? What sediment are they in? What formations are they in?
Good question. So the dinosaurs that are found here in Georgia are, again, of course, in marine deposits, but there are some formations that hold dinosaur fossils. There's one formation called the Blufftown Formation, and this is in South Georgia. So the rocks that are close to North Georgia are a little bit older from the Paleozoic, and then there's a middle part called the Piedmont region that has igneous and metamorphic rocks, and you're not going to find dinosaurs and fossils in any one of those. And so when you go South Georgia to where the coastal plains are, there's a place called Columbus in Stewart County, Georgia, and that's where a lot of the Cretaceous sediments lie. A lot of those are from 70 to 80 million years old, and the dinosaur fossils that are found are disarticulated remains of tyrannosaurs. We have ornithomimids. We have pieces of raptor dinosaurs, and so these were all bloat-and-float carcasses that settled down and became fossilized.
So let me ask you this. There must be a lot of mosasaurs and plesiosaurs and Cretaceous fishes in that stuff too, right?
Oh, yes. Yes, there is. Yeah. Now, Georgia doesn't have a complete mosasaur or plesiosaur. You have to go to Alabama to go there to find that stuff. But we do have plesiosaur teeth. We have mosasaur teeth and mosasaur remains. And so a lot of that stuff is here. You know, a lot of these animals, possibly even Tylosaurus, existed here. And Tylosaurus is one of the largest known marine mosasaurs.
It's a big one. You know, my favorite one, Cam, is the one that's found from Alabama, is Globidens.
Globidens is a really interesting mosasaur. The dentition is very different. So these animals were going after different prey. So a typical mosasaur mouth is going to have those sharp dagger-like teeth. A Globidens mouth has these rounded-like teeth for crushing clams.
Yeah,
it's not like anything I've ever seen
before. They have softball.
Like a Desmo?
No. They're almost like little golf balls or whatever for teeth, right?
Yeah.
If you think
of a Hershey's Kiss. Think of like that kind of structure of a Hershey Kiss, how it's very round at the bottom. But instead of a Hershey Kiss having a little point to it, think of it as just a little small knob at the very top.
Well, Ray, do you remember the nut-eating fish in the Amazon that you looked in their mouth? It looked like they had a bunch of human molars because they crush nuts. So are there remains of are there oyster shells? There wouldn't be any evidence of, you know, them eating their last meal and dying.
I haven't seen that, but I don't doubt that there is evidence of that.
You might find a critter or two with stomach contents in it if you're lucky. But hey, getting back just a little bit to some of the story, there was a big turn for you as you went into high school.
Ray, junior high school. Talk about rocks.
I know.
I'll get there.
We do get there because.
Okay, good. Dave, you ask your question. I've got a Georgia question after
Dave
this.
Dave and I have this dynamic going. I like to get into the personal story, and then he wants to talk rocks, but. I love your personal story, and you and I share a couple things, actually, we have in common.
Oh,
we both are recipients of the Ruth Palmer Paleontology Award.
Cameron Muscoli and Dave Troll, winners.
Well, but you got from PRI, which is a very cool thing. You're the current one. I got mine in 2015. But we also know, and I think both dearly love Tony Martin and Ruth Showalter, right?
Yes.
Who are they?
Tell us about you running into Tony and Ruth.
Who are they? So
Tony is a ichnologist, and that's a paleontologist who studies trace fossils. And he lives in the Atlanta area, and Ruth Showalter is his wife, and she goes on, and she's an artist, actually. And I actually met Tony when I was in high school. In fact, Tony Martin was actually my very first paleontologist that I actually met. High school was a minute. I've only graduated.
Well, you're 23 now, right? Or 22?
Yeah, I'm 23 now. It's only been 4 years, so I should be able to remember. But I was in the 10th, I believe I was in the 10th grade or the 11th grade when I met Tony Martin. And I actually met him at the Fernbank Museum of Natural History. It's in Atlanta, Georgia. And I messaged him on Facebook. I'm like, hey, is it okay if I come with your class, because he's a environmental professor at Emory University, and I was his Emory student for about a day, and that was a lot of fun.
That's cool.
And so I was strolled around the Fernbank Museum looking at the dinosaur skeletons, and I was kind of his dinosaur dictionary. I'm talking about dinosaurs with Tony, and we were talking about sauropods, we were talking about Argentinian dinosaurs, trace fossils, looking at the ground, because the cool thing about the Fernbank Museum is their floor tiles are completely made of Solnhofen limestone.
Oh, well, that's cool. Solnhofen is where the Archaeopteryx was found in Germany.
Yes.
So it's also a limestone quarry, and you can actually pave it. But you're also doing a thing. So the Fernbank has been real pivotal in your life as well. You're doing CAM's Fossil Jam there, right?
Yes, I'm doing CAM's Fossil Jam at the Fernbank Science Center, which is connected with the schools and the Fernbank Museum. I used to go in there about maybe two or three Saturdays a month during the summer, take fossils from my personal fossil collection. I switch it up from rocks, from minerals, from fossils, because there's things about the Atlanta area that really people need to know about the geology. It's super important. And a lot of people really don't know what's here in the state.
Yeah.
And I like to bring that and talk to other people about that.
So you've been doing the Fossil Jam actually in person at the Fernbank Science Center there. You haven't been able to do that since the pandemic, but you're a team member of Time Scavengers, and I was trying to figure out, what is Time Scavengers? Are they associated with the Fernbank?
No, Time Scavengers is actually made by two invertebrate paleontologists, one from UMass. Her name is Dr. Adrienne Lamb, and she, I think, is a micropaleontologist doing oceanography or something like that. If she watches, she's going to kill me because I don't know what she does. but I know she does forams. I know she does foram stuff. And there's another paleontologist. She is now a collections manager or assistant collections manager in Michigan of invertebrate paleontology. Her name is Dr. Jennifer Bauer. And she works on invertebrate fossils. So she does things like blastoids, which are also echinoderms as well. So she works on the systematics and the taxonomy of blastoids.
What is a blastoid? Sounds cool. It's not a Star Wars thing?
I think of it as like, so there's a Pokemon character called Blastoise. So I like to make that comparison, even though they're not even related. But
right.
I like to be a nerd. So
with the Time Scavengers, so these two paleontologists, they ask you to be part of the team. And so what do you guys do with Time Scavengers? Is that an online thing or what?
Yes, it's an online blog. So we talk about everything from research, from what it is like being a scientist. We want people to actually, you know, this is what a scientist is. It's not just some old dude, you know, with a lab coat with beakers. This is what a scientist looks like and the representation of what a scientist looks like. We talk about everything from basic concepts of paleontology, geology. We touch on evolution. We touch on climate change. And so this is a particular blog that teachers and other people can use for their classrooms and other things like that. It's sort of an educational blog.
Yeah, it's cool. Wow, and you're part of that. Great.
Yes, and I've been talking about some of the things that I've been doing from field work, from educational resources and things like that.
How do people find you, Cam? Do they just hear about you via social media? And
social
media has been really important to
you. We'll have links
That's cool.
Cam's page for all his social media links. So I want to talk rocks.
All right. We'll get to
rocks.
So
Cam, you're in Georgia there. What part of Georgia are you in?
I'm in Gwinnett County.
Okay, where's Gwinnett?
So Gwinnett is North Georgia.
Okay.
So it's metro Atlanta.
Okay, all right. So can you describe what Georgia look like in the Cambrian and what it looked like at the end of the Cretaceous?
Oh, yes. Take us from the Cambrian to the Cretaceous. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can take you through the Cambrian all the way through just the entire geological time scale.
Yeah, because in the Cambrian, it was part of the supercontinent. North America was.
Yes. Laurentia is the name.
But with the four different
geologic zones in Georgia. Well, I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah. So it really depends on where you are. So in Atlanta, during the Cambrian period, we don't have any fossils. A lot of the Cambrian sediments are actually in the Appalachian Plateau region in the Valley of the Ridge. And that consists of shales and sandstones and limestones that got deposited during the Cambrian. And around in the Atlanta area, it's mainly archipelagos and volcanic arches that existed during the Cambrian that eventually became the building blocks of Atlanta. And so the fossils that we particularly find in the Cambrian, the oldest ones are known as archaeocyathids. And I love those creatures. They're super cool. They are the oldest fossils in Georgia, and they are date back to about 516 million years old. And so if anyone doesn't know what an archaeocyathid is,
I don't.
Should. It's super cool. Okay.
Enlighten us. All right. What are they?
So archaeocyathids are actually, it's a debate between geologists, and they think that they're probably sponges or corals. They're sponges to the fact that they have a vase-like structure, but some sponges have spicules in them, which are like the skeletal makeup, but these sponges don't have spicules at all. And so it's leading paleontologists to debate whether these are actually corals or whether these are sponges.
But so the word archaeo means old, so it's yes. The first, it's kind of the first evidence of this type of organism.
Yes. It's some of the oldest fossils we have here in the state. And they actually come from a rock unit called the Shady Dolomite. And
I know that guy, Shady Dolomite. So are stromatolites related? No.
Stromatolites are algae mats.
Where do they fit in?
They're a little bit different. They are algae. But speaking about stromatolites, Georgia has Cambrian stromatolites.
Really?
I was able to actually look at Georgia's stromatolites. I've never seen a Georgia stromatolite before until I actually gone into the collections and actually saw the laminations of that algae buildup. And it was absolutely cool to actually see that. And I've seen the thin sections of where people cut a thin section of the stromatolite, and you can perfectly see the lineations of where the algae left that mat over 500 million years ago.
Yeah, very cool.
So we also have a great abundance of that, but we also have trilobites. And yes. We have, I saw Ray, he's up and at him there when I mentioned trilobites.
Trilobites? It's my middle name.
So where in Georgia and how old what kind are they?
So the trilobites that we have here date back from about 505 to about 497 million years old. So that goes back from the middle Cambrian all the way to the upper portion of the Cambrian, transitioning into the early Ordovician. And so the trilobites that I was actually able to find were in soft shale, and they actually consist of soft body remains. And
really cool.
And the cool thing about Georgia is we have a Burgess shale type preservation here.
Really?
Which, yes.
Oh, a Lagerstätten.
Yes. We have a formation called the Conasauga Shale, which runs through Tennessee, Alabama, and Georgia. And we have an abundance of soft body remains. So we have similar preserved Burgess shale type fauna in Georgia to the stuff that's found in Canada.
Wait, so you've got like Opabinia and creature Anomalocaris and those sort of critters, jellies or what?
No. He's saying it's that type of preservation, but it's much later. It's late Cambrian to Ordovician.
Yeah, it's middle to late Cambrian to Ordovician now. We do have similar type fossils like Noria, which is a arthropod that is also found in the Burgess Shale. We have similar brachiopods, if not the same brachiopods, that are found in the Burgess Shale that we find here in Georgia. But my plan is to find an Anomalocaris, and there is possible Anomalocaris pieces out
Ooh,
there.
Ooh, nice.
And
nice.
We just really haven't found evidence of that.
I think there's some Anomalocaris bits that have been found in Nevada, maybe, but I might be mistaken there. But let me ask you about this. You found a Cambrian trilobite in Georgia, Aphalaspis buttsi?
It's fun to say.
Am I saying that right? Buttsi? Buttsi?
Yeah, you're saying buttsi. You're saying that right.
Buttsi. I like that. So
who named that and what is it?
You found one, right? It was rare.
I found it in the northeastern section of the Conasauga Formation. And the cool thing about this trilobite is me and another paleontologist, his name is Bill Montante, and he and I rediscovered that species. So it's been known from the 1940s, but it hasn't been in that particular location since then.
So what do you mean you rediscovered it? So it had been known about it, and then they lost the specimens or something?
The specimen's been known about it, but in that particular location, it hasn't been known to have been found.
I see. So you reached out to your trilobite connection, and they confirmed it.
Yep, and they confirmed it, yes. And the specimen right now is at the museum collections. It's at the Teller's Museum in Cartersville.
So it actually did not go into your personal collection. You knew it was scientifically important, so it's in a public collection.
Yes. It was in my personal collection for a while, but I just recently donated along with some other fossils that I needed to donate to the paleontologist there.
Very cool. So we've only made it through the beginning of the Ordovician, and we still have all the way to the Holocene.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Georgia, is then on the coast? It's on the coast of...
Pangaea.
Yeah, it was on the outer ridge of Pangaea during the Carboniferous, the Pennsylvanian period, all the way to the Permian. In North America, the Carboniferous is broken down into two pieces. So you've got the lower portion of the Carboniferous, which is called the Mississippian, and then you've got
the Pennsylvanian.
Exactly. And then we have a pretty good abundance of fossils there. We have, in Georgia, the Mississippian brought lots and lots of cherts and limestones during that time, and brought a wealth of fossils as well. I was just in Rome, Georgia, which is in northwest Georgia, close to the Tennessee-Georgia borderline. And I was with a paleontologist there from the University of West Georgia. And he and I, we went out to a couple of Mississippian rock units. And we collected brachiopods, we collected fossil sponges. But my new research with two other paleontologists is a really important discovery for Georgia. And he found a shark tooth, one of these early shark teeth. And so I'm working with Dr. Ryan Schell.
Yep. You got my interest there. So this is Mississippi? It's Pennsylvanian? Or
It's Mississippian, yes.
So it's can you give me a hint as to what this is new science? This sounds interesting to me.
Yes, we don't exactly know the exact shark tooth, like exactly what the genus it belonged to, but we do know it's from a coelacanth shark.
Okay, coelacanth.
Yes,
and they're very cool prehistoric sharks, and they got very big, some of them, but yeah, that's cool, man. Wow.
And I'm working with one of your people that you interview, Dr. John Paul Hoddit.
I was going to say. You should talk to JP, but I know that everybody's talking to everybody on the web, and so JP's the guy, Hodnett, yeah.
Yeah, I'm currently working on a recent paper with him on another shark species that we need to go out and publish. And actually, it's actually going to be my first published scientific paper once it gets published.
Wow, that's very cool.
Age 23, that's awesome. So, you know what, you're the youngest paleontologist we've had on PaleoNerds, so congratulations, Cam.
I'm getting kind of old. I'm a fossil myself.
No, I'm the fossil in the room. I'm the boomer.
Hey, you geologists, can you tell me, is chert basically, it fractures conchoidally, usually, like obsidian does, or glass, and is it organic material that is metamorphosized? What is the composition of chert? Is it silica? What is it?
Yes, it is. It is quartz. It is silica. Now, there is some organic components to some cherts. Not all cherts are going to be made organically.
Okay.
Some of them can be made through chemical processes deep below the Earth's surface. Some of them can be in veins, can be in hot water veins and hot fluids. But some of the organic cherts that you typically find are going to be composed of these siliceous ooze from the spicules of sponges.
Really?
So you can actually find some cherts today and take a thin section and even dissolve it, possibly, and you'll find spicules, the skeletal remains of sponges. And so
that's so cool.
Yeah.
Siliceous ooze, that's fun to say.
Okay, but wait, you memorized a lot of these chemical compositions. Why does chert fracture conchoidally?
What's conchoidally? What's that? What's conchoidally? What's that?
Oh, if you're ever napping an arrowhead, when you take a chert or flint or obsidian and you break the edges, it
fractures in a curve like a chip, and okay. that's called conchoidal fractures.
Okay.
Yep, and it makes great arrowheads. A lot of the arrowheads that you see are made Archer. Of obsidian.
Yeah.
So it's the reason why that is because of the antinomical buildup, the actual atoms that make up the quartz itself. And typically when you have maybe a hard mineral like quartz, it will separate that atomic bond, and you'll get a break because of how those atoms are arranged within the quartz.
Oh, right. So the curve, the breakage that's a curve or a scoop out is based on the chemical bonds of that particular mineral.
Yeah, it is based on the chemical bonds or how strong those atoms are inside of that mineral.
That's cool. That's so cool. I didn't know that.
Interesting. Hey, well, rather than going age by age through all the cool fossils from Georgia, mm-hmm. what are the coolest fossils from Georgia? What are the highlights of Georgia's fossil record for you?
Well, for me, I mainly study Paleozoic fossils. So I mainly mm-hmm. study fossils from about 505 to 200 million years old. And so I really haven't gone and collected fossils from the Eocene or the Cenozoic or the Cretaceous. I mainly stay to the northwest side of Georgia because it's easier to get access to. And it's just what I'm really into. I'm really That's into cool. crazy, cool invertebrate fossils because we have so much of the Paleozoic here. But it's just super hard to understand because how the geology is set up. You know, you'll typically go to South Georgia and you can find, you know, Cretaceous oysters or you can find sand dollars. But you're going to be finding some of the oldest known records of life that's found here in Georgia if you go up to the northwestern side of it. And so you'll find things like plant fossils. I've been able to actually go out and collect plants, fossil ferns from coal mines that are there.
From the Paleozoic, huh?
From the Paleozoic, from the Pennsylvanian. And I was up there last year, and I was able to collect some plant material, and I've even found a lepidodendron pieces out there, which are these giant lycopod trees. Yeah,
yeah. I have a question that's going to be very simple about coal mines. So, is coal layer upon layer of swampy black muck you see, or is it layer upon layer of dead forest? Is there kind of a swampy muck to its composition? Because if I'm not mistaken, John McPhee once wrote, the transmutated remains of plant and animals, if it's not cooked enough, it becomes coal. If it's cooked too much, it becomes shale. And if it's just the right temperature and it has to be very fine marine organisms, it becomes oil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really depends on where that depositional environment is. So a lot of the coals that's found in eastern North America typically are composed of delta sediments. And so a lot of those swamps and those forests actually occur on the edges of those delta sediments. And so when those trees and those plants die, they get buried, and they get buried even more over time. They actually turn into to the peat, and they turn into the lignite and coal and things of that
nature. Right. How thick can the seams be in North America, the coal seams?
They can be hundreds of meters thick. Alabama has probably some of the thickest deposits of coal in eastern North America.
That's 500 feet thick. And how many years does that represent, a 300-meter seam?
That could represent over maybe a couple thousand years. So think of every time that sediment or
millions
that,
or thousands? Thousands?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Sometimes thousands of years, even probably millions of years. Every foot that you go into the sediment represents over 1,000 years. And so every time that adds up, that gets into 1,000,000 years.
1,000 years is
wow, that's really cool. So let me ask you this, Cam. So the Paleozoic is what really gets you going up there in the northern part of Georgia. But there's a really great Pleistocene record. There's a lot of Pleistocene mammals, Ice Age mammals found in Georgia. But I think one of the outstanding creatures from Georgia for me, being kind of a vertebrate bias kind of guy, is Georgia Cetus.
Oh, yes. I'm happy you mentioned that.
Sounds like a whale.
Georgia Cetus is one very cool creature, and I'm just amazed at, like, why aren't there big T-shirts and displays of it? Turn us on to Georgia Cetus. Turn this guy on to it.
So, yeah, Georgia Cetus is a cool fossil. Unfortunately, I didn't get to see the actual specimen or the cast skeleton. I'm hoping to get to see it one day. But yeah, Georgia Cetus is super amazing. It's a four-legged whale that was mm-hmm. found in Burke County, and that's in the South Georgia. And they've got the weird snout that you'll see in typical archaeocete whales, but it has these limbs still for walking. So this is a transitional animal, and a lot of people don't know about it as much as like Basilosaurus or Dorodon or things of that.
I think that's what's so astounding, because this is the walking whale from the United States. Beautiful fossils, from what I understand. We always associate it with Pakistan and India, those deposits over
Does
there.
Does it have any of the marine, or adaptations for water, like webbed toes or
it's got a blowhole.
Basal tail?
It's got a blowhole.
It's got a blowhole.
What? It's got four legs and a blowhole?
Yes.
Okay, that blows me away. Is there any transitional fossil that shows nostrils migrating from the front of a mammal? Or they were ungulates, right?
Mm-hmm.
The front of the nose to migrating all the way to the top where the blowhole is.
Ooh, that's a good question. I do not know enough anything about whales.
Yeah,
we have some marine mammal folks we could talk to, but I'm pretty sure there you can watch those nostrils migrate. Move.
Yeah, I know you interviewed Dr. Robert Bosenecker, who I
got. Yeah, we already had Bobby. Yeah.
Yeah, so he definitely can answer that question for you.
Yeah, so Georgia Cetus, but there are a lot of Pleistocene stuff, or is there...
Yeah, there's definitely Pleistocene stuff. And one thing about Georgia Cetus, the state fossil of Georgia is a shark's tooth. They need to replace the shark tooth with Georgia Cetus. what are you guys doing?
So megalodon teeth are found along the Georgia coast too, right?
Yes, I have a few megalodon teeth, though I didn't find any.
Ray is one of the largest in the world.
Yeah, that's a real nice one. Yeah, we do have megalodon teeth.
Since I'm going to test you here, and we can do a screenshot of this if you want, Dave, but what is this?
Looks like a mammoth tooth.
I beat you to it.
All right.
Come on, okay. You're not going to out-cam Cam here. This guy's got a photographic memory.
So when you're doing your fossil...
Show it up, and we'll do a screenshot. Smile. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Hold it close there. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Yep.
So, actually, I had a friend who found this in Kansas. It's a Colombian mammoth, and they didn't know what it was. And they said, we found these, and they're out in Grandpa's shed. And I went, oh, my God, those are mammoth teeth. And they were like, what? And you must have that experience when you do your fossil jam. People must bring fossils to you, and, you must blow their minds with wool, or you break their hearts. Yeah. Have you had those experiences?
I've had some experiences. I know there are some people who thought that some of their rocks were possibly dinosaur fossils. And I'm like, if you found it in Atlanta, chances are it's not a dinosaur fossil. I'm sorry.
I was that kid. I love dinosaurs so much. Every rock was a dinosaur bone. But yeah.
There's a Facebook group called Fossil Rock and Identification. And so many guys post nothing. And they say, how much is it worth? And the guy... Sorry, dude, that's a rock. That's a concretion.
Let me tell you, I'm like, if you see me on there, I'm like, oh my God. I've actually left a lot of these groups because it's just, they don't post. When you actually want a fossil to get identified, you need to post location. Location is like one of the most important things out there.
And then a banana or a ruler next to it.
Scale. Scale is also important. I know a lot of geologists have been getting on me about scales, and I haven't forgotten scale since. I even put myself as a scale.
Yeah. So if you want to post a fossil, you need to have the location of where it's found, preferably one of those centimeter ruler strips next to it.
Yes.
Yeah. And if there's color in it, a color bar.
Yeah. In a color bar. I know people may not have exact location, but try to get as detailed as possible.
Yeah.
And what I tell people is try to understand the geology of where you are, because if you're trying to find a dinosaur fossil and you're in rocks that don't have any fossils in them at all, it's going to be difficult to try to identify something like that. So I really try to hammer on knowing a lot about the geology of where you are, find a geological map, go to a geological survey if there is one, or go to a museum and talk to a geologist that they have on staff and say, hey, I really want to know what the geology is around me. And so understanding the rocks and where they are is going to help you identify the various fossils that you may find out there.
Rule number one is go to where they are.
Yes.
So, and then you may find them.
On our website, we have a link to, on paleonerds.com, we have a link to Macrostat, which shows the geologic sediment below your feet anywhere in the world, anywhere in the world. And when you click on it, it will show you not only the name of the formation, but all the research papers associated with
it. Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's called Macrostat.
We also have a link to Mancos, the app on your phone that you can use. The geology at your fingertips. I just want to ask you.
Ask the magic question, Ray?
Well, no, a little broader question here just at first. Actually, speaking of having scale bars, when I Google your name, Cam, I come across some interesting things. You were once used as a scale bar for Megalodon.
Yes, that was really cool.
What?
Yeah, Cam versus Megalodon. That's kind of a, you were used as a skill. Like, here's Cam and here's Megalodon. How did that come to be?
There was a paleontologist from British Columbia who reached out to me. She's like, hey, I want to use you as a scale bar for Megalodon. And I'm like, okay, cool.
Well, that brings me to the question is that...
Well, wait, was it a giant museum exhibit or just a jaw?
It was an online thing.
It was an online thing. I've actually got to see a reconstruction of Megalodon when I was out there in Gainesville, Florida, and I went to one of their museums. Super amazing.
It's a cool image, though, online that she ended up using. So there's Megalodon about to eat Cam. So it's right there. But just, you know, in terms of social media, you started using social media early on, and that was your way to connect with fellow fossil nerds like ourselves. And you've had a pretty positive experience with social media, right? I mean, it's really helped you get your interest out there. And
it's helped me not only get my interest out there, but if I really didn't have the connection of social media, I probably wouldn't have gone to my first scientific conference presented at GSA. I probably would not be starting on writing my first scientific papers. So social media has really been an incredible experience for me, because as a kid, there weren't a lot of people that I could go to who had an interest in paleontology. I had a teacher back in the day. His name was Mr. Cormier, who was an earth science teacher back in my middle school. And he and I, we would go and talk about rocks, and I would sometimes skip class. In fact, the teacher would allow me to skip their class to go into my earth science teacher and talk about rocks. He and a couple of maybe other people were really the only people that I had who had an interest in geology. Creating a social media account back in, I want to say, 2013 was really, really cool. And I got to, you know, connect with like Tom Holtz and James Kirkland and some of the quote unquote OGs in vertebrate paleontology.
No, that's, I think, you know, social media gets a bad rap, you know, quite a bit, but I think it really, there's a lot of positive things about it, and this network of people in paleontology, and that's how I came to notice you, right, is via social media. And then when I saw that you had a Paleo Nerd t-shirt, it's like, we got to talk to this guy. He is one cool guy. But all right, I'm going to ask you the question, man. Here it comes. You maybe you listened to a few, so you know this is coming. So Cameron, if you could go back in time, if you could pick your epic epoch, your favorite paleo period, the most awesome age of all time, when would you want to go back to, and what would you want to see?
Ooh, okay, that's a really good question.
You knew it was coming. Come on. You get to go back.
I know what you think I'm going to say. You think I'm probably going to say the Cambrian.
Well, surprise me.
I'm going to say the Ordovician.
Wait, I've got that shirt on.
I almost forgot you got the shirt on. Is
that the age when trilobites totally diversified?
Well, what would you want to see and why?
Trilobites start their diversification in the Cambrian, but we start to see some crazy wacky groups in the Ordovician. I really wanted to see those big, giant orthocone cephalopods.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
I really want to see those giant things. I mean, some of them can get about several feet long. We have the giant squid today, but it's like, we don't have really anything that big with like a hard shell.
They were like 30 feet, some of them, size of big logs.
Yeah, some of them were like 30 feet. And I really want to, like,
These are ice cream cone squids, basically. Yes. These are ammonites. No, wait, were they ammonites?
Ammonoids, I would say.
Ammonoids with the ice cream cone shells.
They weren't exactly ammonites, but they were very similar.
Correct me, dude.
But we don't have much evidence of the soft-bodied parts of ammonites and cephalopods from back then, right?
There was just a paper published like a couple of days or weeks ago.
Yeah, the ammonite without the shell.
Shell, yeah.
Yeah.
But didn't tell us if there was tentacles or not, or you know, yeah. Arms. But the thing about these giant Ordovician cephalopods were that they're 30 feet long, the orthocones. How do you imagine them? Are they upright in the water column? Are they?
I kind of remember of like a submarine, because they had that very thin, I think it's called the siphuncle.
Yeah.
Where you have those gases and
that would help for buoyancy. In between the sections.
Yes. That actually helped for buoyancy, and those were probably animals that were, of course, like a lot of cephalopods were swimming backwards. And so that particular feature really helped ammonoids and cephalopods be able to float in the water. And so I think finding those large cephalopod shells and imagining something as big as it's absolutely incredible.
Now, do you want to swim with it, catch it, or eat it for calamari?
Ooh. Calamari sounds pretty good right now. I'm not gonna lie.
I'm kind of hungry. Really, it's lunchtime hungry. Here. It's lunchtime here in Alaska. Well, cool, man. That's a good vision. I like that.
I would probably swim with them. I mean, I wouldn't go too close because they're super vicious.
Ask my question here. I'm impressed by how young you are and how much you've done. Congratulations. So my question is, what advice can you give to kids out there in middle school or in high school that have the same dreams that you had and maybe not the same opportunities, although you seem to have really taken advantage of everything that you could, going to the library and doing what you could. For me, it was reading books on magic. That's what I went through, every single book on magic in the library, and you did dinosaurs. So what advice would you give to someone who wants to become a paleontologist, but they're still in primary education?
Yeah, that's a good question. For me, growing up, I didn't have a lot of those opportunities. I found every single opportunity I could in regards to try to get my foot in the door with paleontology. And so the thing that I would probably say is reach out to people, reach out to professors or even the paleontologists out there. Before I had a social media, I would like write letters to paleontologists. I wrote a letter to Jack Horner a long time ago. Now Jack and I are friends and he knows me, but I reached out to a lot of paleontologists via email. And trying to say, hey, I really want to be a paleontologist, but I'm not exactly sure. And paleontologists are willing to talk to you. I know there's plenty of people who are like, oh, I love answering emails from kids and even adults who really want to try to get their foot in the door with paleontology. So taking the initiative and emailing those particular scientists is one thing that I would say is important to do. Another thing that I would do is read. Read a lot. Don't just read about dinosaurs. Read about biology. Read about genetics, because a lot of that is all connected to paleontology. For me, I taught myself how to identify rocks. I taught myself a lot of the chemical formulas. And so being out there and trying to identify rocks and fossils, being able to go out in the field, is all super important. And again, reach out to scientists. I am going to be starting my first paleontology internship in just a few weeks with the Mississippi Museum of Natural Science. And I'm really excited about that. And the reason how I got that internship was going to my first scientific conference.
Right. That's basically, don't be shy. That's great advice. Don't be shy. And there's emails and there's websites. Find those people and ask the question. Don't be shy.
Yeah, reach out, make the connections, yeah.
Yeah, and even if you are shy, you know, try to step outside your comfort zone, because you never know where these people are going to take you in your future career.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's good advice, man. That's really good advice. Do you have plans to go? I mean, you're out of high school. Are you planning on going to college at some point? Or
yes.
You're already doing paleontology. You're already doing scientific papers, but you hope to do the whole traditional route?
Yes. For me, I struggle a lot because I'm on the autism spectrum. I struggle a lot with, I have major dyscalculia. So I have a really hard, it's a hard problem with like math and numbers and things like that. Oh. And I have slight dyslexia. But that's something that I'm working on overcoming and helping to push through to get myself into a college. One of the colleges that I really want to go to is the University of West Georgia. I'm already good friends with the professor of geology there. His name is Dr. Brad DeLine, and he's the one who found that shark's tooth that I'm working on, that I'm eventually going to be writing a scientific paper on. But that's one of the colleges that I aspire to go to study geology and eventually get my bachelor's degree in geology and then work further into becoming a professional paleontologist.
Yeah, that's cool. You know, I mean, speaking of, you wrote to Jack Corner, and he's now you've been emailing with him, and he overcame a lot with his